Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Golden, and welcome to Making Markets. This show explores the psychology and structure that make up markets all over the world. Each week, we speak to experts about a different market so you can see what actually happens when money changes hands. From mainstream stock and bond markets to esoteric niches like vineyards, antique art, and crypto, we explain the transactions that underpin our economy. Making Markets is part of the Colossus family of podcasts, and you can find all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources at joincolossus.com.
Eric Golden is the CEO of Canopy Capital. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the views of Canopy Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes and should not be construed or relied on as investment, legal, or tax advice. Clients of Canopy Capital may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast, including positions that are contrary to the opinions offered.
My guest today is Yossi Levy, better known as Car Dealership Guy, who has quickly become one of the most popular voices in the auto industry. Last year, I spoke to CDG about the U.S. car market and the business model of car dealerships, but he was anonymous at that point. Today's conversation covers Yossi's personal story and media business. We start with a quick overview of his fascinating backstory, from a used car dealer to tech entrepreneur to now a media founder. We then dig into his media business, talking about the business model, target audience, and the content treadmill. We end the conversation with a section on the U.S. car market, where we cover demand and supply, the affordability challenge, and the battle between fully electric and hybrid vehicles. Please enjoy round two with Car Dealership Guy. CDG, Car Dealership Guy, is back. This is a fun one because I've been lucky enough with the podcast to talk to a lot of famous people, a lot of successful people. And I think that you were one of those people that everyone was like, you know who CDG is? And I did know who you were. Maybe I was one of the few. When you were anonymous, I knew who you really were. And people were just fascinated by you. They love your content. They love your Twitter profile. So I guess I'll start with your now, I don't know if it's a Hollywood production video, but the video is, who the fuck is CDG? Why don't we start there?
Well, I'm not an airport in France, I'll tell you that. That's for sure. Everyone's like, Charles de Gaulle Airport? No. It's great to be here again, Eric. It's been a crazy journey in this media world, which similar to you, I fell into. But it's been really fun, seriously, educating the public, building a big following. It's not something I expected. My background, I'll give you the SparkNotes version. I did put out a video on this on my Twitter page and my YouTube channel. It's a 13-minute documentary that I spent 4 months producing just to explain my story. And so the SparkNotes version here is, I was a used car dealer. I actually got in through this through family. My father had a very small used car line in Philadelphia. I think 10 cars on the lot just to make ends meet. I got into this in my teens, grew within the business, always was waiting for the moment to get out of the business, applying to internships at JP Morgan in New York and all that fun stuff. But the business just sucked me in. I had a bigger and more meaningful role as the years went by. And found myself in 2018 at this point. I was running the company now for 4 years, had grown it to 30 million in sales. You were a traditional used car lot. And I asked myself, what is the next thing in this car industry? I knew that I had lots of opportunities, a lot more potential than I was fulfilling at the time. And I said, I want to really bring innovation. And to me, after doing my homework, doing my research, I believe that there's a better way to sell a car and that we could do it online. Now, the insight that this was rooted in was that 70% of my customers were coming to our lot and they ended up purchasing a vehicle that was not physically present on the lot at that moment. So let me explain this. We had cars down the street in additional side lots and storage lots because we were in the city. There's not a lot of space for parking. So we had to park them off site. And we realized that people were coming to us for the name, for the brand, but they were actually leaving with a different car than they initially came for. And the insight I had back then, Eric, was, why do we need a physical lot to sell a car if anyways, people are buying cars that they didn't come for? we were predominantly subprime at the time. That was our market. But it told me that people nowadays, or at least a big segment of the consumer base, is not vehicle dependent. They're not necessarily saying, oh, I only want to buy a Subaru. I only want to buy this. And so all of this led me to saying, okay, I'm a used car dealer and I'm going to do the stupidest thing ever. I'm going to launch a venture-backed online auto dealership. Now, why venture-backed? Well, I knew that we needed money and I knew that to do this the right way, we needed massive scale. And so in 2018, I did something crazy and I actually pivoted the business from a traditional family-owned used car lot to a venture-backed complete online auto retailer. It was wild, to say the least. But that was the start for my company called Get a Car. So I launched Get a Car in 2018. And I spent the next 4.5 years building, again, what was an online auto retailer. We grew very aggressively over that time period, raised over $50 million. At our peak, we did $83 million in sales, a team of 200, offices overseas. I mean, the whole hoopla. We were delivering cars from all of the Northeast. It was an incredible growth story for the time. And we really delivered on our value proposition. But come the end of 2021, we just started going through a really rough time. And we couldn't compete with Carvana. They had crazy coffers. They were out competing us on the online marketing and practically everything. Our burn just started accelerating. Our unit economics started deteriorating. Our customer acquisition cost was rising. Everything that could go wrong was going wrong after, I would say, July of 2021. And that led us to a point where we knew that we had to pivot the business, downsize, find a way to get the profitability, which never ended up happening. I tried for a year and a half. We tried private equity. I mean, we tried all these things, didn't get there. Now, in the meantime, I'm over here. I'm a founder. I'm a creative. I am not a PE guy. I'm not a financial engineer. Like, that is not how my brain works. And I found my job had turned into everything that I hate. I was doing finance and like, oh, how are we going to do this? Are we going to acquire this deal? It was just horrible. I mean, laying off people, it was just terrible. And so I started this anonymous Twitter account. And I said, let me just have some fun. This will keep me creative, keep me going. So I have some energy to do all this crap that I hate during the day. And I would say from the beginning of 2022, it just grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And all I was doing, Eric, was just sharing insight, just having fun, sharing what I'm experiencing, what I'm seeing on the ground floor. At the time, I was really sharing what I was going through. Over time, Car Dealership Guy, which today is a platform, which we'll get into, I began sharing much more than just what I was going through. I began sharing data, insights from the overall market, and really trying to paint a picture of what is happening right now in the auto business. Think of me as aspiring to be this collective intelligence of the automotive industry. And so that is really what I unintentionally set out to do. That's my story. Happy to explain it, dive into any specific part if you have any questions there.
I think the documentary is extremely well done. I think it's a great American entrepreneurial story. It's a very cool thing. I love your father's perspective in it. Was your father first generation?
Yeah, my father came here, I think, in 1986 to the US, started working at a car wash, traditional, or I would say the stereotypical American dream story of working his way, grinding, long days, long hours. And so, yeah, that was the story.
The thing I liked about it was his perspective of, I want to get into this just industry-wide, but I mean, car dealerships didn't have a great reputation. I think people felt like they were getting ripped off, or there was an asymmetry of information. The car dealers knew stuff, they knew how to do stuff, wash cars, make them look better, and maybe you got the short end of the stick. And that might have been an overperception, but part of that comes from the secrecy of the industry, of stuff you don't talk about. And I love how your dad was saying when he started doing this, hey, bud, you might piss off a lot of other dealers. And I think that that's such a true statement, that there's a lot of industries where, look, we all know how this works and we might be upset with each other, but we don't say this stuff out loud. And I'm curious about the backlash there, because I think that there's lots of people that want to share insights about how it works. And maybe anonymous was the way to do it, longer anonymous. But did you feel any blowback or pressure from competitors as your influence started to grow?
And are you referring to the Twitter account or are you referring to the dealership?
You correct me. It seemed like at the dealership, you were doing really cool marketing stuff, getting people in. So that seemed very creative.
And there was blowback, by the way, at the dealership.
On that?
100%.
Okay.
Oh, 100%. I was this young, rogue, no holds barred, just tear down the walls. Let's share. Nothing was done maliciously. We're talking about, if you're going through a vehicle history report, just know that it's probably not fucking accurate. It was stuff that I didn't think was controversial, but it was not 2024 either. in 2016, 2015, you have to realize we're going almost a decade back. It was a lot more taboo to just go on the internet camera to the face and say these things about your industry. So things have changed in the last decade, no doubt about it. My dad was right. At the time, it was a little uncomfortable. We also weren't used to the social media game like we are today. Even when I started this account and I was anonymous, I remember there was some stuff I would say that people would, I'm not sure, this and that, but I feel like the game has changed. Today, like, transparency is the expectation. And I want to do one thing and one thing only. I want to uplift automotive for dealers and consumers. I'm not here to be a dealer shill, and I'm not here to be your number one consumer advocate. I'm here to offer objective data, things that are just rooted in numbers as much as I can, and offer my context and insight from 13 years in this business of what that could mean for the car market, having been on the ground floor detailing cars to in a boardroom raising from billion-dollar hedge funds or whatever. So that is what I want to do. And I feel like knowing that that's my goal, I think people see that. People believe that. They see the truth. You can't fake the funk when you're tweeting 18,000 times in 24 months. I mean, people see who you are. Your personality shines through. At the end of the day, I feel like this has impacted the industry in a positive way and happy to continue pushing it forward.
So this is how closely I follow you. You tweeted something about a dealer, a note that you got, that they did something that maybe some people would have viewed as unscrupulous about someone's credit. And it was really, to me, a deep insight into the industry that there was a certain brand that might be struggling with oversupply, and a way to push product was to maybe lower credit standards. You deleted the tweet right away. That's how close I thought. And that pullback, I was like, okay, it didn't seem taboo or bad to me, but I wonder now where your brand's so big, you say something or you report something and you're no longer the Anon kid who people were just like, a couple of people followed. Now, when you say something, it has bigger consequences.
I love that you bring this up. All right. So this was 2 weeks ago or something. It was my dad's 60th birthday. We're in Fort Lauderdale, living it up, Sunday morning. And I had this guy that he's senior position in a dealership setting. He sent me all this stuff about pretty much implying fraud at this specific dealership. And so, again, doing what CDG does, I don't remember exactly what I wrote, how I worded it, but I pretty much posted this. I was like, hey, this is the result of conditions and market. I wrote something along those lines. But here's the bottom line. It very quickly got up to Volvo's executive team and whatnot. Very quickly. I'm talking about within hours. And here's where I felt like I made a mistake. I wrote something that I felt in hindsight lacked some context and could potentially harm every single Volvo dealer out there because of something so blatantly messed up at this one business. And people could agree or disagree with me. But as soon as I feel with my conscience that I did something wrong, and I felt like the right thing to do was for me to post something that could harm every single business owner that happens to own a Volvo dealership now, is just not fair. Plus, yeah, I did confirm to a certain extent who this person was, but I didn't have physical documents and stuff like that. And I'm not a reporter at the end of the day. And so I said, this is just not fair. And so I deleted it. And then I wrote a little post. I said, look, I make mistakes too. And it's important for me to own that. And I should have added more context before posting something like this that could adversely impact thousands of other business owners across the country. And so I think people appreciated that. But you're right. That was probably one of the very few and rare post that I've ever deleted due to a content-related reason that wasn't just a shitty post that no one liked or cared about, rather a post that I felt like I probably did something wrong and I should apologize or at least fix my mistake and delete this.
Yeah, I think it shows the reach that you have now. And I think it's honorable that you're appreciating when you say stuff. Now lots of people are listening. I want to talk about the market of influence that this is. I think it's interesting that your dad comes to America, builds a great business, works his butt off, has this opportunity for your son to take over what presumably is a very successful cash flowing business. You then transform it into this big thing, and now you're doing media. I want to learn about the economics of this. We've talked about it off air before. We've got some different opinions about media and content creation. And so what is CDG now? You've got your podcast, a newsletter. You're not selling cars anymore, but you're wildly influential. So what is the economic model for CDG?
I haven't shared these specifics, and I'm happy to do it here because it's pretty recent. But CDG, we are building the most premier destination for automotive insights. So think of us as this platform where we are aggregating info and insights and content from the industry. We speak with everyone, and then we take that, we pretty much put our context to it. We produce videos, podcasts, newsletters, social media content, and much more to come in the future, blogs. And we put that out for the world in order to uplift dealers and consumers. And so that's who we cater to. We are a media platform. So we're doing anywhere between 60 to 80 million impressions a month right now. That's across all of our 7 media properties. We're a bootstrap business, full-on media. So all we're doing is selling media and advertisements. We're not selling any cars. We did that early on, but I realized that, listen, at the end of the day, I enjoy this media game now. I didn't know I would, but we spoke about it. I fell into it, and it's what we're doing. I'm all in on advertising and growing the business.
The notion that who you think of as your audience. So I think that you probably get hit up way too often. I've done it in DM, so I already apologize. I'm about to buy a car, CDG, what should I buy? And you're very gracious, but that's not what you do. That's not your business. You do it for friends maybe, but you're not looking to give people, hey, go buy this car. This is what you should sell your used car for. It seems like a much more economic driven insight for dealers, but how would you articulate what you believe your audience is and what you want it to be?
So that's an interesting question, because my audience, I think what's so unique about the brand is that I do appeal to consumers, enthusiasts, dealers, the entire investors, the finance professionals, really a big, broad spectrum. From a media perspective, my monetizable audience, my ideal customer profile is really the dealers. My advertisers want to get in front of dealers. And so dealers are ultimately the people consuming my content that advertisers want to get in front of. They have budgets, and that's where they spend a lot of money. I don't really have advertisers or are trying to get in front of consumers, but I do have a lot of consumers that follow me. I think the interesting thing is I have an audience of dealers and consumers, which means that I have an opportunity in the future to launch something that brings together dealers and consumers. Obviously, I've piloted a marketplace and stuff like that. I've sunsetted all these initiatives because I came to the realization early on. I said, look, I want to build a powerful media platform and I want to build distribution. And I'm not in the business right now of building marketplaces and whatnot. But it is an interesting opportunity that's obvious and clear to anyone that sees that I have dealers and consumers who follow me.
Let's talk about content creation. You went from selling cars to selling ads. And part of this is it feels exhausting. Sometimes people think influencer is negative, but people who have large Twitter followings, built YouTube channels, newsletters, where the business, it seems like unless you really love it, it's an awful grind that you've got to put out threads and you've got to have an interesting take every 5 minutes. And if you don't, you're going to lose it because of the attention of the audience. You're just going to lose it and suddenly go the other way. I'm curious how you think about content creation, how you map it out, how you're coming across, what your creative process is like.
First of all, I have this rule where every single week or every single day, we just have to get 1% better, because it is an insane treadmill to create content. I'm working hours that are absurd right now. We have 3 kids under 3 at the household. Life has gotten crazy. And here's what I've done. When I started, it was all me just rogue tweeting. Over time, I started getting proprietary sources, data that's only available to me. And I just started building a little content library where I could access. And again, content was always being refreshed and added. Today, I have a small team. So we're a team of 4 individuals full-time. We have 5 contractors that help us. I'm still the bottleneck in content, because you have to realize that I have a very unique type of media property. And I hate to make it sound so transactional or media property. No, this is like my life. But it's a very unique type of asset, because I'm sharing insight. You see these content creators that like hire ghostwriters and stuff for like this like very vanilla content. This is not vanilla content. This is insight and context that you can only really have if you've really been doing this for a very long time, or you're very close to the pulse of the industry, to the right people. It's insider information for the car market in a way. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And so I'm just still very close to the content. So what we've done over the last couple of months and what we're working towards more and more is we basically have mapped out all my content. So if you look at my 18,000 tweets that I've ever put out and you map it out, you might notice that only 40% of those, or 50% of those tweets, are things that only me and I could have said, as an example, stuff that's in my experience. But then the other 50% is stuff that I didn't need to do or post or aggregate or whatever. And so I'm working to slowly build leverage and have people do the other stuff for me, starting with the lowest hanging fruit, posting stuff like my podcast or stuff that, again, is very black and white. that's being delegated. And over time, we're working to delegate more and more and more so that the platform is less reliant upon me and more a real business that is scalable. And so we're chipping away at it. We've been doing a good job. Our head of content, Cole, who recently joined, he's been really leading this effort and he's been just doing a great job, but it's not easy. And I can tell you that unless you're willing to put in the work and the hours, especially in the first 2 years of content creation, like you'll never be able to scale because the reality is content creation relies on you until it doesn't. And it's just like a baby, it's an early stage business. You have to be there. I'll tell you the truth. I'm still on the computer every day. I take a break from like, I don't know, 7:30 to 9:30 or so, 10. But then I'm back on the computer at night because there's just too much shit and I didn't get to it during the day. And so it's a treadmill. And I think the faster you can build leverage and delegate around yourself, the more sustainable a business, the less key man risk, the more valuable it is, and the more sustainable ultimately, because it is very taxing.
You bring up a great point. I wasn't going to mention this, but it made me think of something that happened in the Twitter information industry where it really is about authenticity. People feel like that even when you were Anon, they feel like they knew you. They're strip mall guy, car dealership guy. We don't have to go too into it because it's not that critically interesting, but for people who don't follow Twitter as deeply, there was this whole farm of guy Twitter feeds. And I think people found out that it was really just one person or a group of people maintaining them. And people were mad and upset about it. And it was so interesting because I think the way they got to it was the content lost its authenticity. Someone started to connect the dots that they're all starting to sound alike. And it was just such a fascinating moment that you guys have hundreds of thousands or millions of followers amongst like the dealership strip mall guy, the people that these cover these really cool industries. And people were really upset that they felt like they were betrayed by this, that it wasn't a person talking to them, giving them insight. I was curious if you had any take on that because you're thinking about scaling, but people still want to hear from you directly.
So I was anonymous. The reason I was initially anonymous was because this was just a fun Twitter account for me to be dumb and stupid on and whatever. And I wasn't going to put any of my stakeholders at risk for my dumb takes. Let's just set the record clear. Now, my brand exploded in growth. And I found myself 2 years in where I'm not just a little Twitter account. I'm a relatively influential voice in the industry, which is amazing. And I didn't know how to get out of it. I was like, I'm so deeply invested in this. What do I do now? A weird position to be in. I'm getting into phone calls with people. And they're like, so tell me about yourself. And I'm like, I was a dealer. Then I was a venture-backed tech entrepreneur dude. Then that didn't work out, unfortunately, but I got back up and I launched a media business. It was such a confusing story that I just literally went to first principles. And I said, how can I explain this to the world in the most intimate, authentic way where people are going to really understand what the hell happened here? And I came to the realization that a video was the only way that I was going to be able to accomplish that. And so I literally went and hired like a producer and all these things and created this video. But your point stands. One of the things that was going through my mind and the reason for my timing as well was that I knew at some point identity was going to get leaked and whatnot. And the reason that concerned me was because I would not be able to control the narrative once that happens. I want to tell my story. And so that was my thing. I said, this is going to make life way easier. I was actually really excited about it because 1,000 people knew who I was already, but I said, let's go, let's double down, let's produce this video, and let's tell the world who I really am. And by the way, I'm not going to get trapped in this anonymous fiasco or whatever that happened with all these other accounts, which is a whole nother ball of wax. So
let's move to the type of content you're creating, how people on Wall Street think about it, how market makers, how industry leaders, looking at the auto industry, we look at it as a huge indicator for GDP, how many cars are being purchased, what supplies look like. So give us an update on the macro outlook as you're seeing the automotive industry today.
We are in an interesting time. I would say that at a high level, it feels like the industry is back to some level of optimism. 2023 was not a pretty year. Vehicles are starting to decline in valuations. EVs took 15 to 50% hit in valuations, Tesla being on the upper end there. New car supply started rebounding. I'll tell you an exact stat. I mean, today we are roughly 50% over where we were a year ago in terms of new car supply. So we've gone up about 870,000 units available on dealer lots. These are new cars. We're still 30% below 2019 levels, but remember, we're 50% above 2023 levels. And so we are making a meaningful way up. That's led to price declines because supply has risen. used cars, I would say, have remained in pretty short supply. That sort of has buoyed the used car market. And what's exacerbating the issue is simply that we undersold cars for the last 3 years. And so what happens when you don't sell enough cars? Well, you have fewer cars that are being returned as leases are ending now. And so that's sort of buoying the used car market there. I would say all in all, we're still hovering around record prices for new and used. New cars are around $49,000 new, and used cars are around $25,000, $26,000. And so for the most part, things have stabilized. I do think there's some optimism now that we're past 2023, but there's still lots of clouds on the horizon and lots of question marks, really.
On the numbers, I'm curious, do you look at it on a payment basis? Because I'm always interested. I remember going back to the financial crisis, when the economy crashed, people were wondering what was the first thing the consumer would walk away from economically. And there was this question of if car leases and car payments were an easy thing to default on. The thought was people never defaulted on their house, and now they're walking away from a home. Will they walk away from a car? And there was two schools of thought. I don't really know. I didn't follow it that closely. One was the reason why people don't default on their cars is they need them to get to work. So if they want to keep their job, they need the car. And I'm wondering if we've seen anything in the default spike pickup for cars because of remote, that car payments aren't as critical as they once were.
Historically, from all the data I've seen, stuff like car defaults and stuff, let's just say repossessions ultimately, they correlate pretty well with unemployment and the economy. And so for as long as unemployment is pretty stable and we don't see a massive spike, it's tough to expect for defaults to spike either. Now, delinquencies have risen. We've eclipsed 2019 levels already, and they're still rising. It is concerning. Banks are tightening. If you're deep subprime, that's below 500, really. It's the worst of the worst, or your credit's shot. You almost have no shot of getting a car without a meaningful down payment. Deep subprime today is making up 50 basis points of new loan originations. Subprime is making up 5%. And so even subprime is not doing too hot either. Prior years, it was 10% even at some points, or 9%. And so what I would tell you is that it's something to watch. We're in a weird position in the market because people purchased these vehicles in 2021 and 2020 for record prices. Those unprecedented numbers. A couple years in, maybe they need a bigger car, maybe family's grown, maybe they bought a piece of shit car back then and they just need to trade it in. But guess what? They're out of equity. And people are always out of equity. That's not anything new. But the velocity that we're seeing it right now in the market is a lot greater because people, with the crazy mean reversion we had over the past 12 months, people lost a lot of equity in their vehicles and they're finding that they're owing a lot on these vehicles and they're underwater. And so it's a very tricky time in the market. Lenders have tightened up. You've seen some layoffs on the lending side. You've seen them just be a lot more picky with who they want to work with, require bigger down payments. Interest rates haven't helped on that end either, because today, if you look at the average auto loan rate on a used car, is almost 15%. It's crazy. And if you look at the average auto loan rate on a new car, it's 9%. And so it's a really, really weird picture, which if I had to summarize it all, if you have money, if your credit's decent, you're fine. You can get what you want. You'll manage. But the reality is it's a tale of two worlds because it just has never been tougher to buy a car or to finance a car.
So we're seeing a bunch of weird stuff in the home market where people are doing seller financing or just trying to get people to move homes with the interest rate move. With 9% averages, and I'm curious what the range is from high quality to low quality for a new car. Is that demand being initiated by, like, are the dealers stepping in and offering dealer financing? Or is it all incumbent upon the banks opening up the credit spigot to increase demand?
So initially, when the rates started rising, credit unions were the hottest thing in town. They had at some point up to 30% market share of new loan originations. Now that's reverted, and in part by the fact that credit unions, they just don't have unlimited dry powder. You can only put so many billions and billions of dollars of loans on the road. And again, they have a better advantage in their cost structure, but again, they're limited. And so what you are seeing now is the captives. So if you're a Nissan dealer, you have Nissan Financial. Toyota, you have Toyota Financial. You're seeing the captives step up with more incentives and stuff like that and rate subsidies. And that's resulting in the captives grabbing a bigger market, a piece of the market share. So I think they're around like 60% market share, up from 45% a year or two ago. And so captives are definitely on the rise. They have more market share than traditional lenders and credit unions. But that's where you're seeing rate subsidies, really. I would say to look at specifically at the vehicles, you're seeing some good rate subsidies on least desired vehicles or the vehicles with the highest day supply. And so things like EVs right now, I'm not talking about Tesla, I'm just talking about non-Tesla EVs. They are selling roughly twice as slower as a normal internal combustion car. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it doesn't matter the reason. That's just a fact right now. There's less consumer demand for them. And so you're seeing a lot of manufacturers really incentivize or attempt to incentivize consumers with just rate subsidies, rebates, and stuff like that, because these EVs are just piling up on dealers' lots of crazy.
The stat that you've shown, I think it's interesting. It doesn't sound very positive. Prices are down. But if people have followed you, one of the interesting numbers is the general undersupply, that we had the shock and that we weren't producing enough cars. So are we still under production levels of where we would be pre-COVID or pre-2019, however far you want to go back?
We are very much under production at like pretty concerning levels. So let me break this down. First of all, if you look today, you have about 20% fewer used cars in dealer inventories than you did in 2021. So today you have about 2.3 million available units on dealer lots. A couple of years, got about 2.9 million. So let's just start there. You have fewer cars in dealer lots. Now, that's part of the reason why used car prices haven't dropped more. They've stayed pretty stable. Yeah, they've come back 10% from their all-time highs, but they're still up over 30% versus 2019. So now let's fast forward. In order for prices to come down, you need more supply. Where do you get used car supply from, though? You get it from people returning leases. Well, if you remember in 2020, 2021, 2022, we didn't produce enough cars, which means that we did not lease enough cars. And because we did not lease enough cars, it's estimated that we have a 5.5 million unit shortage that we're going to see through all the way through 2026. So if in a normal year, 4 million leases are returned, we're going to see anywhere between 2 to 3 million over the next 3 years. And so that is a really big problem. That's going to put more pressure on used cars, and that's going to keep prices higher. The only way that the bottom just falls out from used cars is if the market cools so much so that car manufacturers put such crazy incentives on new cars, which pretty much puts them at parity with used cars, and then used cars just have to fall in price because you have new cars that you could buy. But again, that's a big but. Like, will we see anything closer to that? That would only happen at a really crazy clip if the market really cools and if unemployment rises, and we probably have much bigger problems on our plate at that point. So again, sum that up, there's some concerns on the horizon. We are just going to see fewer used cars enter the market. And it's really unknown how that's going to impact prices. It won't lower prices, I can tell you that. The only question is, will it keep them stable? Will it lower the pace of the decline? Or will certain pockets of vehicles, certain segments actually increase in price?
What does it mean for dealer economics? As I'm hearing you say that, it's like, okay, prices don't seem like they're coming down, but borrowing costs are going up. So the consumer is going to put more of their household budget to buy this thing. And I'm just wondering, if I'm a dealer and I see lack of supply, that's a good thing, but the cost of this is going up for my end consumer. So I'm wondering, do cars stay on? Does it take a longer time to sell a car in a market like this?
Look, it's a double-edged sword, because you might make more margin on some cars because you have a car that there's fewer of them in the market, obviously, but your volume will just be lower. You can't buy used cars, then what are you selling? It's a really tough market. I mean, everyone is struggling with sourcing used cars. That is the toughest thing in the market. And the other thing is, how do you price them once you source them? How quickly do you get rid of them? Because it's just been such a fickle market, I believe. In October, November, we had this like big drop in used car valuation suddenly. And then, boom, it rebounded. It's just really, really tough to predict. This is not a normal trend where you see like a 15% annual depreciation. Things are really volatile. And it's tough to be a used car dealer from that respect right now, because it's tough to plan out. You really need to be cautious with your inventory acquisition. And everyone is talking about one thing in this industry, and it's called your turn time. How long are you keeping that vehicle on your balance sheet before you sell it or do something with it? And you better hope that nowadays it's 30 days on a used car, because if it's more than that, you're probably going to lose some money.
Are you seeing dealers closing? Are we at a point where you're in a dealer depression, where there's people that are getting blown out by this?
You're seeing it with dealers that didn't manage their, maybe that they overextended on debt, stuff like that. For example, dealers that were too reliant on inventory lines of credit, like a floor plan, they struggled, or maybe they lost their floor plan. That's always a big reason for people closing, meaning the bank pulled out, hey, you got to refinance this in 90 days. You've seen a lot of dealers close, but every used car dealer that's closed so far has had a weak balance sheet, or they've had some mismanagement. Many times it comes down to inventory because it's such a capital intensive business. But I would say you're seeing a lot more of it than you've seen in the last decade, for sure, because it's just been a very volatile time. And how does that Warren Buffett quote go that I'm sure every person listening to this knows way better than me? You find out who's swimming naked when the tide goes out.
You got it. You mentioned EVs. I think it's an interesting topic, something Wall Street loves to talk about and speculate on because of the companies. And a point you've made, which I don't think goes unnoticed, is that Tesla and EVs are separate. But you pointed it out. I've heard it from friends that are looking. A lot of my friends who would love to own an EV just aren't there yet. So they're going to hybrid and they're saying, I want to buy a hybrid. And then when EVs get to whatever where they want them to, reliability, distance, whatever, they'll switch. I'm curious about your take on EVs, Tesla versus the majors, and hybrids.
Look, I think EVs are here. They're not going anywhere. They're going to keep rising. I think that the pendulum swung too far. I think car manufacturers were way too aggressive, came out with these proclamations, EV by 2020, whatever, 2030, and all these things. The market is always the ultimate decider in these things. And the market said, nope, not happening yet. EVs today, I want to say, make up 7% market share roughly, up from about 5.9% a year ago. So they're growing. Obviously, it helps that there's government subsidizing that growth. We really don't know how EVs will stand on their own yet because we just haven't seen that day. But what I will tell you is that I'm a deal hunter. I don't care if a car runs on air, water, shit, it could run on fumes, whatever. But I'm a deal hunter. And so the way I see it is if you just want to get, relatively speaking, a deal on a vehicle today, yeah, EVs, you can get a deal. If you hate EVs, then that's not the choice for you, but that is definitely out there. But the pendulum swung just too far. That's why you've seen EVs drop anywhere between 15 to 50% in price over the last year. Some models, some Tesla models actually dropped 50% in price. It's really tough to say what this next period we're entering will look like, but it already seems like, I won't say prices have reached equilibrium, but I will say I am noticing that as prices have cooled and rebates have risen, that the demand for EVs has also risen. So prices are more attractive and people are coming to them.
And what about hybrids? It seems that that's had a different story than the EV market.
So hybrids have been really hot. Hybrids have stolen the show over the last year. And I think it's a testament to people are maybe not ready to make the full jump yet. I saw a funny little analogy on Twitter that someone posted, like, remember the old VCR and DVD thingies where you could put both of them? You could say that's inefficient, that's dumb, but the reality is like people bought it. There was a market for it. So I feel like hybrids are just stolen the show because they are what majority of consumers still want. Will that be the case in 5 years? I don't know. But today it is the case. Toyota's killing it. They are by far the most in demand in terms of they have the lowest day supply right now out of any automotive manufacturer in the market. Still, it's been like that for a couple of years now. They've just performed extremely well. It's been the biggest growth over the last year, I want to say or so, in market share has been hybrids.
You mentioned that the deals and EVs may be offering enough deals to get to bottoming out and hitting equilibrium. Where are you seeing the best deals and the worst deals or the highest demand and maybe the lowest demands?
So you're always going to see the best deals on the more expensive stuff. So anything over $50,000, $60,000, that's an EV. You're probably going to see a pretty badass rebate. If you look at Audi Q8 e-tron or the BMW iX, or I actually posted about one person that follows me. You may have seen this, that he bought Audi GT or whatever it's called, the electric Audi, and he got like $36,000 discount, something crazy. It's like a $110,000 car. And so, yeah, anything over 50, 60K, you're just going to see the best rebates by far, especially if it's anything that's an EV. Anything below that, it's going to be more competitive. The bloodbath is 25 to 35K. Everyone's competing in that space. And so you're just going to see maybe a bit less on the rebate side because it's just not as expensive of a unit and the market for it is a lot bigger.
Well, so my favorite brand's Porsche. What is going on with the fact that people are building, depositing money and then finding out like they're not getting cars, that we're still having this build problem?
I just had this Porsche dealer on my podcast and dude, I mean, fascinating the stuff he shared behind the scenes about it. But here's what I can tell you. A Porsche customer is a lifelong Porsche customer. they've saved up or they've worked their whole life. They want that car. They're not going and saying, oh, I'm going to buy a BMW. Then they want a Porsche. That's what they want. So they're going to wait for the car they want. That's why Porsche is the most valuable franchise from a multiple perspective. I don't know, 10X or something on average. That's what they trade at. Those cars are just always in demand, always being in demand as far as I can tell. And they're still doing super well. You can't get them.
So what I'm confused about is it feels like steel Rolexes. So when Rolex was launching, they realized that if they cut supply on steel, not rare metals, the price went through the roof. And Porsche suddenly starts to feel like it's acting like Ferrari. Ferrari had this behavior. It was hard to get and you had to wait and the whole song and dance. And they were just, that was their reputation. But it used to be you could go buy a 911. And now what I'm curious about the Porsche brand is that strategically being done? Is that a supply constraint? What's happening?
I wish I could tell you what the discussions are within the Porsche management room. It's hard for me to say, can you really not make more 911s? What I'll tell you is Porsche's day supply is at 68 days. That's a little bit below national average, which is 80. It's a lot higher than like Toyota, which is at 36. Now, but here's the thing. That is their average day supply. That is not the 911 day supply. And so it's an exclusive car. It's tougher to get. You're going to wait for the right one. You're going to definitely wait for that.
What do you think about the brands trying to move into the exclusivity stuff of these higher prices? So one car that I thought was interesting that crosses over here was the Ford Lightning. I thought that would do really well just because I see F-150s everywhere, the EV thing. And it feels like cars like that are the Hummer. I'm curious with, you've talked before about America is just getting bigger and bigger cars. And then the confluence of EV, it did seem weird to me. I think Escalade's releasing now an EV car that we're getting these big cars in EV. Is that just a bad idea or something that you think might stick?
I think that the market has voted. I don't understand how these manufacturers work, these big companies. I feel like it's so simple. If I was in these people's shoes, before making these big political proclamations, I would pilot it, start releasing some, sell out. Produce more, sell out more, see what people want, adjust, find product market fit. These brands went all out on these models. They put all their eggs in one basket. They just went all in. I just don't understand the logic behind it. What's the upside here to risk your entire company by making these crazy investments in something that's so unproven? You're not a startup. It's not like you're doing this risk off balance sheet, some investment. It just doesn't make sense to me. Listen, Toyota's taken a very disciplined approach. They've just played wait and see. I mean, recently they were like, hey, we're not even going to invest in EVs. We're going to just buy EV carbon credits or whatever, which was a funny thing. But the point is a lot of undisciplined attitude and just behavior in this space, which just boggles my mind why they would act like this. But look, again, I've never been a Fortune 500 executive. And so I don't know what drives those decisions, but it is what it is. Here's what I'll tell you. I think that a lot of it was just way too hasty. They're dealing with the consequences with this lack of demand on a lot of these models. Don't go crazy. Pilot it. Try it out. See what people like. Adjust. Iterate. But they went all in and it's just not selling as well because the market doesn't want it, especially in that market that buys any of the pickup trucks. I'm not saying people don't want it. I'm just saying that demand is not commensurate with supply. It's just not there. The balance is off. There is demand 100%. It's just not in line with the levels of supply that have been produced.
If you were a manufacturer, you've said that the car you want to build is the Spirit Airlines of cars, which sounds odd to me. But why do you want to build the cheapest car in the world? And why do you think this is the untapped demand that people are missing?
I think we just have an affordability issue. You ask every dealer, what's your biggest issue? It's finding affordable cars, it's budgets, it's payments. We have a serious affordability issue in this market. It's not that you can't buy a $17,000 car. That $17,000 car is a micro Nissan Versa that you can't fit a toothpick in. This is fantasizing. But imagine if you had a $7,000 or $8,000 Chevy Impala, something full size. That would sell like crazy, obviously. But the point I'm trying to make is that I just feel like we've added all this technology and the cars have gotten so sophisticated and CarPlay and SmartPlay and just things have gotten so nuts. Who's going to be the person that's just going to zig when everyone's zagging and just come out with, I call it like the Spirit Airlines of cars, where everything is extra, but where the base fare or the base price is just very affordable by the masses? Will it be the Chinese? It could be. don't be surprised if China comes in a very big way. I think they're coming into the auto industry, just like the Japanese came in the 70s or 80s. It's going to happen. And so the question is, who's going to do it? What's the price point going to be? And how much more value are they going to deliver to the market relative to the other competitors?
Yeah, it's been hypothesized that someone's going to do it. I've always wondered if there is a lower bound, if it's a safety or just manufacturing costs. Like, I do wonder, when you wrote that, I did think it was interesting. I think it was spot on that there's clearly this demand imbalance. This is why it's booming the used car market. So it is interesting. And I'm wondering, can you not make money on a really low price car? Are there safety concerns? It just costs more than $10,000 to build a car. I just have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, safety, US government regulations for sure. It's more stringent than other countries around the world. It's a lot lower margin, 100%. It just is. Again, look at people that are buying cars left and right nowadays. It's people that have money. They want something better, a bit more luxurious, more disposable income. It's incentives. If you look at Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, like Stellantis, their prices have increased since 2019, 50%. That's more than any other brand. They came out with the Wagoneer, this fancy large SUV. And again, everyone is going upstream, or everyone has gone upstream. And someone is going to go downstream in a big way. And the question is who, when, and to what extent?
Yeah. No, I think it's a good prediction. I think someone's going to do it. The interesting thing will be if it's a Chinese manufacturer, does it hit regulatory hurdles or is it allowed or are there qualms about it? As you look out, the dealers are obviously worried about supply, the current market. But if you look out a little bit longer, what are you feeling or hearing from the dealers about their general take on the economic landscape? Where are they thinking for a little bit longer?
I think the increase in supply has been concerning, as you can imagine, if you're a dealer, because your margins are just deteriorating very quickly. Obviously, pandemic was peak margins. And relatively speaking, you're probably going to get to 2019 levels. But when that salesperson got used to making 5x earnings and they adjusted their lifestyle, it's a slap in the face when you go back. Even though, again, you're still making 2x earnings, there's a lot of that happening right now and in many industries, but specifically in auto. I think there's some concern on used cars and making sure that you can manage through the undersupply that's coming and the lack of lease returns. Some brands more than others have done some questionable moves. Nissan recently announced they're selling more cars to fleets, rental car companies. Why is that an issue? Well, 3 years ago, they said they would significantly minimize it. And now I think it was recently over a year or the quarter or something, like 46% of their sales, some crazy number. And that just hurts residuals on every other Nissan out there in the market, which pretty much means that if you're a Nissan dealer, your cars are worth less. And so the point I'm trying to make is manufacturers are starting to get squeezed with more supply. They need to find outlets for the supply. It's hurting dealers. It also hurts consumers that own these cars. Again, they see more depreciation on their vehicles. But all in all, I do feel like in light of the adjustment that we've gone through over the last year, I do feel like there's some optimism that we're in the more normal, predictable pattern. You can say definitely not normal or predictable, but it's more normal and predictable. And so that's positioned dealers to maybe continue operating a little bit more aggressively now and focus back on growth and stuff like that.
I had mentioned that your episode was one of the most popular ones and people should go back and listen to the first one. But one of the most common DMs I got that was stood out of how consistent it was from the consumer side. You talk to dealers, I talk to more consumers, was the question about why dealers are structured the way they are from a people standpoint. Why do you have to talk to one person who shows you a car, sells you a car? And I noticed this recently with like your delay from when a consumer walks in. It's pretty cool that they keep the time from entry to sale. Why is it always structured in this hierarchical where there's lots of salespeople, but then there seems to be the manager who's making every buy and sell decision? And has anyone ever zigged and zagged beyond the Carvanas and the Getta cars to try to break that mold?
Okay, so the dealership is structured. It's no different than any business where if you are a sales manager who knows how to get a deal across the table, well, you need leverage. And so you hire people that are compensated less than you to slam the phones and stuff like that. It's just like any business, different roles and how specialized that role is. That's at the core. Now, the way people have changed that model in our shop, we call it cradle to grave, beginning to end, that's been done in some stores. Some stores still do it. And there's technology out there that's enabling more of it. I recently partnered with a company called Carmatic, which are doing something like this as well. They're trying to empower the salesperson to actually give you your real numbers and stuff like that. So what you're saying is the right customer experience. That is the vision. We should be there. But the reality is that it's still a pretty complicated purchase. You need to get lending through a bank and you work with 15 banks and you have to know what each bank requires and how to submit a customer's information to the bank. And so that is a specialized role in dealership. And so the salesperson who is maybe greeting you, working with you, showing you the vehicle is not necessarily specialized in that F&I or finance. So they'll pass that on to a finance manager or a desk manager. It depends on the type of dealership you're in. The roles are different. And so that is really the reason for it. It's still a pretty complicated purchase when you're dealing with all these third-party banks. Remember, it's not just you. You're dealing with a bunch of other third parties. And you just need to make sure that the person doing it understands the rules of the game and isn't making mistakes. I mean, you have a lot of liability. If you put a loan on the road with the wrong information or you write the wrong value for the car, or that comes to bite you in the ass, you got to pay that back. You can get sued. You can get fined. So it's just different roles in a dealership that specialize in different things, and they all have different accountability.
CDG, I always love talking to you. I think you'll be a regular guest to give us your macroeconomic take. So we want to end these podcasts with the same question. Where do you think we are in the fear and greed cycle right now?
Ooh, good question. So look, I'll just preface this with it's definitely split. I don't feel like there's a general consensus, but I do feel like we are leaning into optimism. Even though used car supply is questionable and new car margins have declined and there's more, you know, new car supply, people feel like we've gone to some more normal pricing patterns. And if anything, actually, the lack of used car supply would probably keep prices even more stable across the board. And so I do feel like I'm seeing optimism. February was a pretty good month for car sales. Things picked up. It's normal. It's tax refund season, which is expected. Now we're in March. And things seem to still be pretty steady. Tax refunds are higher this year for consumers. They got them a little bit earlier. So things are pretty good. I do sense some rebounding optimism, and we'll see if it holds.
CDG, thanks for coming. If you're one of those people that hasn't followed CDG, Car Dealership Guy on Twitter, he has a great podcast, newsletter. I highly recommend it. I think it's just a great insight on the general economy, and you can learn something from it. Thanks for joining me today, buddy.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. If people are interested in this and cars, you should check out my podcast, Car Dealership Guy Podcast. We're consistently top three automotive podcasts, all things economics, car market, insights into the business behind the scenes. So we'd love to have you join us. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
If you enjoyed this episode, check out joincolossus.com. There you will find every episode of this podcast, along with transcripts, our weekly newsletter, and resources to continue your learning.